Well, I told Glenn, Dan, that I'm going to be going to the Toomey reception, so I'll probably be on briefly, but certainly wanted to come on and check in for a little bit.
Okay, great. I have to leave actually early, too. Glenn, do you know how long this call is supposed to last?
It's only for an hour, and I know that Bruce is very, very punctual.
Okay.
So I don't think you should have any problems if you can stay on for an hour.
I can stay exactly that long. It's my wife's birthday, and I'll be in big trouble if I don't get...
Ooh! You will be dead.
Yes.
So wait a minute. She has her birthday and Mother's Day all within a few days of each other?
Right, really, it's a shopping challenge for me.
Without a doubt.
It seems to me Mother's Day is everywhere in the world except here in France on the 11th of May.
Huh. Do you celebrate it at all or just on a different day?
Oh, yes. It's usually at the end of May.
I see. Well, May's a pretty good month for vacations there anyway, isn't it? Not as though you suffer during the month of May.
It's a nightmare if you've got to work. Today is a public holiday in France.
Oh, it is?
Yes, so everybody takes off today, tomorrow, and the next day, and the next day.
Oh, my.
And then because they work 35 hours a week, they usually find an excuse for taking off Monday as well.
Why not?
And this is the second weekend running, and we've got two more coming up.
Oh, that's fantastic. Start looking at the want ads in France.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry to make you work today, Glenn.
Oh, no, that's fine. Since I work from home, it's no burden at all, because I went out playing golf this afternoon, so that's fine.
Now, what is it, about 11 o'clock midnight there now?
No, it's midnight, yes.
Midnight, my. Yes.
And I'm a late bird, so it's all right. Mm. I prefer midnight to 4 or 5 in the morning.
Do we have anybody else?
Yeah, it's Rob Hall, actually.
Oh, hey, Rob.
Oh, hi, Rob.
Hi.
This is
Hey, Rob.
Dan,
Brian Cute here, too.
And Dan Halloran. We were just talking about baby's sleep habits. How's yours?
Sleeping through the night most nights. It's great. I kind of take her around 8 and feed her, and then feed her again about 1 a.m. My wife goes to bed at 8, and then I'm off duty at 2 a.m., and she sleeps from, you know, midnight till 6, 7 a.m. It's great.
Good man.
Yeah.
Wonderful. I wonder where Bruce is.
Yes.
I know he knows the number because he sent it to you, Dan.
Yeah, I saw that. I got that.
I'm sorry. Who did you say was on the call, Dan? Who else?
Dan Halloran, Brian Cute, and Glenn.
Okay.
It's Bruce Tonkin just joining too.
Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Bruce. We were just getting worried that you didn't have the number.
No, that's okay. There was a bit of congestion in the international network, though, so it took me a couple of tries to get through.
Oh, I see. So there are only four of us, Bruce, Dan Halloran, Brian Cute, Rob Hoare, and yourself.
Okay.
And there are apologies from Ross Rader.
Yep, thank you.
And Tim Ruiz said that he would be phoning in.
Good afternoon, /morning, /evening. It's Jordan Buchanan.
Hey, Jordan.
Good morning, Jordan.
Hi, Jordan.
Hi.
Somebody has just sent out a big, massive spam from, and the return address is whois-reports@icann.org, so I'm getting inboxes.
That's funny, Dan. We added the same thing for domains@cost.ca here. We're getting about 20,000 an hour now. They're spamming a from address here as well.
Yeah, we're getting that too, Rob, which is
interesting. Melbourne IT, they're using a Melbourne IT address. Sounds like a kind of a concerted attack against the domain name industry.
Could be.
Yeah, maybe it is. You're right. Because it's tied up our mail servers all day trying to deal with just the rejections and the bounces.
Has this been just the last sort of week or so?
Started 2 days ago.
Right.
I mean, we started to receive the bounces, so that means it, you know, could have started a day or two before that, but whoever it is a bad list, because we're getting, you know, tens of thousands of messages every half hour.
I don't think there's such a thing as a good spam list.
Yeah.
But I wonder if it's more like a denial of service attack, because the content of the messages is just kind of random advertisements.
I don't know what the content is of the ones we're getting back, but I'll have one of our operations guys look into it, Bruce. That's a good point. Because if it's just random junk to try and tie up our servers, that would be a problem.
This is Rick Wesson, just joined.
Good morning, Rick.
Hey, Rick.
I just got off the phone with Chris Sheridan over at the registry.
Yep.
About this whole delete thing. The drop names and people feeling like there's some registrars getting more than others and all this kind of stuff. Have you all experienced these things too?
Well, I guess we haven't really paid too much attention. You mean that some registrars are able to get a higher proportion of drop names than others?
Well, that's what some registrars are complaining about.
Right.
I think they're going to have a note that explains everything coming
right
out here in just a couple of hours.
Rick, have you had any emails using your registrar as the from address, sort of bounces? Because Rob Paul for Momentus, and certainly Melbourne IT, is getting a lot of traffic, and Dan was saying that he's getting affected as well at ICANN, where people are using effectively your domain name as the from address in spam.
No, but I haven't checked our mailboxes or our mail servers, so I can go look.
I thought we'd just perhaps wait a bit longer and see if Tim Ruiz joins the call as well, since he was the registrar's rep on the task force. Help for context.
Yeah, Brett Fawcett from the task force is trying to get online right now as well. He just dropped me an email and asked what the number was.
Good.
Did you all receive the automatic invitation?
I did.
I did, yeah. Yes.
I did, but I promptly lost it.
Oh, good. Okay, well, that's fine.
Typical, that tends to happen to me too. It's lost in the 100 odd emails you get a day.
Yes,
just send a reminder.
One thing we are seeing in the deletes, Rick, is we're seeing the latency period that used to be a second or so on a turnaround of a command up to 8 to 10 seconds during the drop period. Yeah. So we're not sure what's causing that. It started about 2 weeks ago. And that certainly causes us some concern, because you send a command and wait 8 seconds to get it back is a real problem.
Yeah. All the domains are gone.
Yeah. So you've got to start timing it, you know, 8 seconds earlier if you think you know when it's going to drop. So.
You know what's funny is I see bounces, but they're for my email address that is in handles at VeriSign. So it's like somebody's trying to send something to old email addresses of mine, but I don't see anything out of the ordinary. Shall we get started? Just 10 minutes.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, Rick. Question is, who wants to chair this? Do you want to chair the call, Jordan, or do you want me to?
Oh, I don't really care. Why don't you do it, Bruce? I'm tired.
Okay, it's the beginning of the day for me, so it's fair. I guess perhaps a starting point would be to get Dan Halloran to just summarise the concerns that the ICANN staff had over the task force recommendations.
Okay. I guess nobody needs an introduction, a bigger introduction about the report itself or the RAA. Should I just jump right into the concerns?
Yeah, just jump into the concerns, I think, Dan.
Okay. I just took another look at it before the call. This comes from a April 11th email that Louis wrote to the GNSO Council because we noted that it looked like the council was right about to just approve these recommendations, and we had some concerns about them as they were drafted. Let's see, we listed concern A, concern B, C, and D, four general areas of concern. Just a nutshell, the report, as we understood it, said that registrars basically had to delete names 45 days after expiration if the registrant hadn't paid a renewal fee.
Hey, folks, it's Brett Fawcett. I just joined. Sorry I'm late.
Hey, Brett. We just started like 10 seconds ago. This is Dan, and I'm summarizing Louis' concerns that he wrote to the Names Council.
Okay, terrific. Thanks.
Sure. So concern A was that the proposed mandatory policy didn't allow for extenuating circumstances. Concern B was that the recommendations concerning mandatory disclosures inappropriately restricted certain registrar business models. Concern C...
Sorry, what was that second one, Dan?
Concern B was that the recommendations concerning mandatory disclosures inappropriately restrict certain registrar business models.
What do you mean by mandatory disclosures? What are they?
In the deletes report, 314 said that registrars had to provide a summary of their deletion policy and an indication of any auto-renewal policy. This policy should include the expected time at which the name will be deleted. And then 316 said...
I don't quite understand how that restricts a business model. That doesn't make sense to me.
Okay. 316 talked about how to disclose it. Registrar should provide both at the time of registration...
Oh, okay. So you're saying it's because it specifies the mechanism, it's not the fact that they disclose information that concerns.
Yeah, it said website, and right
yep.
Now there's no requirement to operate a website. It also said at the time of registration, which just left a question about whether it would be okay for a registrar to change it if they had disclosed it at the time of registration.
Right. Yep.
Concern C was about mandatory payment policies. The text of the recommendation made reference, I don't remember the exact ins and outs of this, but made reference to a payment. Let's see.
Yeah, you notice, Dan, the current registrar agreement also mentions payment.
Yeah,
too, just
Tim Ruiz had a good point on that, and just, you know, when I always kind of gloss through that in my mind, because we always interpret that, it says something about a fee. That's 374 says, registrar shall not activate any registered name unless and until it is satisfied that it has received a reasonable assurance of payment of its registration fee. And we always just interpreted that to mean the fee could be $0. So I suppose you could do the same kind of reasoning there. I think Tim had a good point on that. Concern D was about overlap with WHOIS recommendations. Basically, both the WHOIS task force and the DELETE task force had a similar recommendation about restoring a name about the interplay between redemption grace period and restoring a name that was deleted because of inaccurate contact data. And the recommendations weren't exactly the same, so it was just kind of unclear about what was going on there, if you were trying to strengthen them or change them, or because we're just right now trying to implement the WHOIS task force recommendations. So that was concern D. The meat of it, though, really was concern A, which was our reading of it was that the requirement to delete at 45 days was pretty absolute and didn't seem to allow for any extenuating circumstances. And of course, the the trouble with this is if you allow for just any extenuating circumstances, then that kind of defeats the whole rule, because then everyone can just say they had an extenuating circumstance. But in the emails to the council, we went through and laid out eight hypothetical situations where it, just for whatever the circumstances, it might not make sense to delete a name, even though the 45 days were up. I'll just quickly run through those. Number one would be a case where the registrar learns, say, right at 45 days that it's about to delete the name, but it never sent the note, or the renewal notice never actually got to the registrant because there was maybe some problem with the contact data. Number two, the registrant's main office.
And that would be pretty much common, I must admit. I mean, that's a normal thing, and there are a number of steps that registrars normally take, like they put the name on hold first, and there's a redemption grace period. So that's kind of the bit about the bad contact data is kind of a known problem. I think an extenuating circumstance could be if the registrar's renewal system malfunctioned for a week. That's an extenuating circumstance. But just having on-contact data is a standard part of the industry, and we've already put mechanisms such as the ability to place the name on hold, the ability to retrieve the name through redemption grace.
I think that's right. Maybe I misstated the hypothetical or the concern. The memo said, shortly before the 45-day deadline, the registrar discovers that its contact data for the registrant has been altered due to hacking or some other incident in the registrar's systems.
Yeah.
So, either hacking or something, like you said, like maybe the mailer wasn't working, or you had a typo, or the say you mailed out a notice but it got returned due to insufficient postage or something like that. Number two, or I don't know, Bruce, do you want me to go? Maybe we should talk about each of these hypotheticals at a time, or can we just run through all eight and then...
I think probably, for the moment, let's not go through each of them, because it's probably going to take quite a bit of detail. I think the issue that you're raising is that it's a fact that there can be extenuating circumstances, and given that fact, what's the best way of dealing with it? Now, in my mind, there are two approaches. If you take the approach that was used in the transfers policy, it effectively says that a name should be transferred unless there's some circumstances, and it actually lists them, and it says a name transfer can be blocked if there's a UDRP dispute, if there's a dispute over payment. In fact, it's effectively a list of those. So the transfers approach was to effectively detail what those circumstances were. So there's two choices to this. One is you can say, a domain name must be deleted within 45 days, except, and you list the exceptions, or you say that you just leave it open and say extenuating circumstances, which is the wording we have at the moment. But then you need some controls over that, and the approach I had suggested is, well, maybe you need to provide a report as to what those extenuating circumstances are. And Tim Ruiz raised the issue, well, who looks at that report and what do you do with the information? So I think those are probably the discussion we need to have, rather than argue at this stage over what is an extenuating circumstance. I think we really need to decide on what's the approach. Do we take the approach that the policy includes a list of exclusions that are defined, or do we leave it open and say there can be extenuating circumstances? If we leave it open, how do we stop that being abused? So those are sort of the discussion points. Perhaps at this stage it might be useful to have someone from the task force, Jordan or Brett, to perhaps respond to those concerns that Dan raised from a task force perspective.
Yeah, I think that the perspective of the task force was, as we've made earlier, is that essentially allowing a extenuating circumstances clause is essentially the same as the status quo. Registrars are theoretically not allowed to just arbitrarily carry names that haven't been renewed, but there's just no clear language about what that means exactly, and so anytime you create a loophole of that magnitude that allows them to do whatever, then likely that may be abused under some circumstances and by some registrars potentially at the expense of others. And so we've always tried to craft language that was fairly narrow. The one example that came up during task force discussion. Well, two examples came up during task force discussion. One was a court order, and it was pointed out that there already may be language covering the situation of court order within the registrar agreement. And the second was UDRP, and as you know, there's a now controversial duty on the implementation side section regarding UDRP disputes. But some of the other scenarios, you know, a hacker breaking into the system on the 44th day or the discovery of such a scenario, you know, were not specifically discussed. And obviously there will be some types of extenuating circumstances that may be difficult to anticipate. So I don't think we'd have any particular guidance with regards to how to deal with those particular situations, but the intent of the task force has always been to make exclusions quite narrow if they exist at all.
So one approach, Jordan, would be to effectively itemize some widely agreed exclusions. So you could, you know, itemize court order, you could itemize UDRP, and any others out of these hypotheticals that we think would be appropriate. And then potentially the extenuating circumstances is then dealt with by a report, and that the registrar would need to write a report to ICANN, or maybe even seek permission from ICANN to go beyond the policy.
Yeah, I mean, we get to the point there whether that's a good use of ICANN's time and resources and whether they have them.
And another thing, I've talked informally with some of the members of the task force and also with Louie about, you know, how to craft some, this is Brett, by the way, how to craft some way to do these exemptions. And one of the ways that made a lot of sense to me was perhaps not to require ICANN to do anything, but perhaps to put some caps on the number of exemptions that a registrar could have, you know, based perhaps on names under management, the percentage of names under management, so that, you know, the task force wanted to present abuse, and we don't want to see registrars, for example, you know, submitting to ICANN 100,000 exemptions or something like that. So perhaps capping that number would be a way to do it.
So, Brett, just so I understand, you're putting a cap, but how would anyone know that you were doing any of these exemptions in the first place?
You know, I think that there would have to be some kind of reporting to ICANN when you did want to have an exemption. But rather than say, ICANN, I want your approval for this, just say, ICANN, I'm allotted, you know, 250 exemptions. This month I have 112.
Right, okay. And then not having to, at that stage, define what the extenuating circumstances are unless you exceeded your threshold, presumably.
That's right. It would totally be within the registrar's discretion as to what they wanted to grade an exemption for.
Right. Yep, that's certainly administratively easier to manage. Yeah.
How does that take into account the variations that would naturally occur within the given categories, whatever the categories were? I mean, can you control the number of the pieces of litigation in a given period? Can you control the number of billing disputes or errors that might be otherwise identified as reasons why? How do you account for that without just a numerical cap system?
I think that's Brian, is it?
Right.
Yeah, this is Bruce Hogan speaking. I think probably what Brett is saying is that there is a threshold which would be considered reasonable, but if you exceeded that threshold, then you would need to provide a report of some sort. So clearly, if you had a threshold of 250 and you had 1,000 UDRP disputes,
right.
Yeah, that would be something that would be clearly identified in a report to ICANN.
So it's not a ceiling, it's a trigger that would require the submission of reports.
Or maybe there's a trigger that requires, point, ICANN's permission. But, you know, we don't burden Dan and the other folks at ICANN if you're under the threshold. That might
One of the things, Brian, from an engineering point of view, we often use alarms on different systems where we put thresholds, and often the first thing is establishing a baseline. In other words, what is behavior, then you set a threshold and say, okay, well, if it's 10% beyond normal behavior, then you would reach an alarm. So I suspect that in the early days of trying to implement this policy, you would need a bit of flexibility to determine exactly what is an appropriate threshold number.
Right. And maybe that's something that, you know, during this implementation conversation, we would do some outreach to registrars and find out if this is a this is an approach we want to take, what they think a reasonable number or percentage of names under management would be.
Yeah, that's certainly something we could speak to do, yeah. Okay, who, Rob Hall, have you got any comments on this?
Yes, I have a bit of a different comment. It seems to me that the recommendations keep aiming at this 45-day, you know, you must do this on the 45th day. I have some concern about that, as it seems to be positioning itself as typical behavior is 45 days. For example, we delete the day after it expires. We have no interest in keeping it around for those 45 days. And these policies all tend to seem to be, you know, saying that shouldn't be normal behavior. You should wait the 45 days. And I would prefer that they were worded in such a way to say, look, it could happen at any time. The 45 days is kind of an absolute minimum.
Yeah, exactly what the current language says, Rob. It indicates that the registrar must delete no later than the 45th day.
Yeah, but it just in my read of it, it seems to keep coming back to it, you know, as opposed to it's okay to do it on the second day.
Yeah, I think what my understanding, Rob, is that that's something that is part of your policy, because what this is saying is it should be no later than the 45th day that you should publish what your policy is.
Yeah, it actually is pretty, I think, somewhat generous in saying basically the registrar is able to specify whenever they want to delete it. It just can't be later than 45 days.
Okay. My other concern is you also only give us a 10-day window in which to do it if we start doing it on a certain standard, and that could be a problem in some cases.
Sorry, I didn't understand that, Rob. Where's the 10-day window?
I believe there was a recommendation that I saw that said you only have a 10-day window in which to delete them. If
right, and the idea there being that you can't say, well, I'm going to delete it sometime between day 0 and day 45. You could say, I'm going to delete it sometime between day 0 and day 10 as your published policy.
Well, what happens if I delete them on day 11? Am I in trouble then? So
I would say probably if you did it once, we know what there's no ICANN sanctions policy other than de-accreditation. So if you think you'd get de-accredited for that, I think that would probably be unlikely. But that goes to a broader question of enforcement for any policy like this.
Yeah, this is Dan. I want to jump in just a little bit on the idea of a quota for maintaining these names, or a cap or a trigger. Is it just a general question about how that would be enforced? I mean, like, let's say just every registrar could have 500 names that were past the auto renew grace period that hadn't been deleted yet. How would ICANN know about that, or the registry, or anyone except the registrar? And would we just have to rely on kind of getting anecdotal questions like, hey, these guys seem to have a lot, and then we'd have to go kind of audit them or something? Or it's just I have some general questions about that.
You wouldn't be able to get that information from the registry?
No, the registry just sees them all as auto-renewed names. You know, the registry doesn't see any different from any other name. They've got auto-renewed and is now 2 months...
Yeah, they don't know whether that's been renewed because the registrar has requested it renewed, or whether the registrar has just renewed it. That's what Dan's getting at, yeah. I mean, that's sort of... It is a bit of a self-policing system in a way, in that I think... I mean, for the policy full stop, like, if you have the policy as it is, Dan, and it said no name will be able to be held by 45 days, even that, you would only get that anecdotally, presumably.
Yeah, because those, we would get complaints from people, which we get all the time. Hey, this name expired 2 months ago, but it hasn't been deleted yet. I want to get this name. What's going on here?
Right.
So that.
Whereas you're saying that when there's a threshold, it's more difficult to determine that, because,
yeah,
you know, the threshold was 500. Unless you had 501 complaints, you wouldn't know.
Exactly. Or unless I, you know, wanted to do an audit of that registrar and say, you know, show me all your records, show me all your who is, all your dates, expiration dates, renewal dates, all your payments.
Well, and it seems to me that the policies are aimed to shoot at standard practices of a registrar. So if a registrar is typically doing this, that's a problem. If a registrar does it you know, because of an emergency or extenuating circumstances once, that's probably not a problem. You may have just had a system failure and you know, screwed up.
Yeah, I mean, one way of handling it, Dan, is that the registrar provides a list of the names within that threshold, and so if you get a name that's outside that list, then that would raise some issues for you. So, for example, at the end of each month or quarter or whatever time frame you wanted to use, the registrar provides a list of names which they didn't delete for extenuating circumstances. So it's just a list of names without reasons. And then if you started getting a lot of complaints that didn't include names on that list, then that would give you an indication
that they weren't reporting.
Yeah, that sounds like a very good idea.
Yeah.
And then I could see, just count up those names, how many there were, and then... another general uneasiness is distinguishing among registrars based on size, because I think there might always be an issue there with whether it's fair to small registrars or big registrars. But I think that's going towards the right idea.
Yeah, I think you'd have to have an algorithm along the lines of it's a sliding scale, but it probably has a minimum threshold of X number of names, so small registrars don't end up only being able to have one or something like that.
The greater of 100 or, you know, 1% of names under management, something like that.
Okay, did you have anything else, Rob?
No, not on that point.
Yeah.
I mean, I've gone back and read it again, and I think that the concern I have is the bracketed portion that says generally 45 days after the domain's initial expiration. I understand technically that language may be correct, but I think it positions into the general public's mind that this will generally be deleted 45 days after the expiration.
Oh, sorry, you're reading that incorrectly, Rob. That's showing what the auto-renew grace period is.
I understand, but I'm not sure it'll be clear to the general public is what I'm saying. So technically, I agree the sentence is right, but if we could perhaps restructure it to say, you know, make it a little more clear, that would be better.
Yeah, do you want to send me some suggested wording, Rob?
I can do that, yeah.
We can put it out for review. Okay, else, Rick, did you have Rick Wesson?
I have nothing to add.
Bruce, this is Dan. Can I just throw in one more idea just for consideration? Instead of sending in right now registrars don't have to send any reports to ICANN, which I assume they all like that, and we'd be creating a new requirement to start sending reports to ICANN.
Actually, I thought the redemption grace period, actually, when I read that on the ICANN website, it said that a report was supposed to be provided to the registry and ICANN.
The technical steering group did say that the report goes to the registry and ICANN. And right now, none of that's been finalized yet, but it's being implemented, and the way it's working now is the registrar is giving it to the registry, and the registry is giving it to ICANN. So... but, I mean, let's put it this way. On a regular, there's no monthly reporting requirement for registrars or quarterly reporting requirement, and we'd be creating one here.
Yeah, I'm very uncomfortable, it's Rob again, with having to send something to ICANN for, you know, every time we end up past this 45-day period for any given reason. I mean, it's causing work on our end to inform ICANN.
But not every time, Rob. I think what we're talking about is at intervals, whether it's quarterly or... You just provide a list of names.
Would it be, what I was trying, or maybe driving at, was that instead of reporting it to ICANN, maybe just reporting it in the registrar who is, you know, flagging that name, like this name hasn't been deleted yet because of reasons.
Yeah, the problem with that, Dan, is that might be okay for .com, where most people are using their own who is, but for Biz and Info, typically... A lot of people use the central who is provided by the registry, so they don't provide an independent who
is. Is there any provision in the, I don't know why I don't know this, but is there no provision in like Biz or Info for the registrar to submit additional text to be displayed with the who is?
No, we'd have to create a new EPP extension for that.
But there actually is a provision then that the registrar must also provide Biz for Biz and Info.
Right, but the other problem...
But it can just be the registry data kind of
Yeah, I don't think that's the right place to try and put it. And then what are you going to do to police that? You mean that ICANN, they're going to run a who is mining exercise to find out what names are... I'm not quite sure how you'd even display it. On the who is, you're going to say that sometime in the past, this name was extended for extenuating circumstances.
No, it would just
not a sensible who is entry.
The inquiries that we get are about names that show with an expiration date in the past. whether it's a week or 2 months or sometimes a year and a half, and the person wants to register it and they want to know why it hasn't been dropped yet.
Yeah, but you see, this is where the issue comes in, because if you look at Biz and Info, the registry will show the auto-renewed expiration date.
Right.
And so that's only relevant in .com, where you get some differences between what the registrar displays and what the registry displays.
I have some concerns about what's being talked about, and specifically, it's Rob again. I think I'd be comfortable every quarter sending a report to ICANN saying we had this many, you know, there were approximately 10 domains or what have you, and giving ICANN the right to come back and query what they are if they need be, but I don't see the reason to be sending ICANN every possible domain list that we screwed up with, and unless there's a problem that they think, you know, they need to look into it more.
If we're going to do reporting to ICANN, I want it to be machine readable, and for it to be published either 6 or 9 months publicly.
I have no interest in publishing my screw-ups publicly.
Right.
Sorry.
Agreed. So I'm just saying, if we're sending data out of ICANN for publishing, that eventually that data should become public.
Yeah, but it's not for publishing, Rick. It's basically for enforcement purposes. It's a bit of a
review difference. And enforcement.
And that's the best reason why it should become public, is because if people only if we make ICANN do all of the enforcing, then there's a high likelihood that it'll never get done. And
but
if you make this stuff public 6 or 9 months later, lots of people can do it.
Well, how? How are you going to enforce the contract I have with ICANN?
Well, it'll mostly be enforced through market pressure and shame. It has, in some respects. I mean, there's quite a few... well, I don't need to prove that point. But if we're going to send stuff to ICANN, we're going to have to send data to ICANN for some reason. I want it to be machine readable, and I want it to be publicly available after some time frame.
Rick, I think you'd have a real fight on your hands from us about the publicly available. What you're asking us to report is basically our screw-ups, because that's a lot of what happens to go past that 45-day period is, we had a system problem and didn't delete it.
High
it cost us money to not delete it, and...
Or even if there's an inordinate number of legitimately itemized exceptions that reflect, payment arrangements or other sorts of business dealings, that just because you've exceeded the cap, it's now out there in the public, and I'd agree, I wouldn't want that out in the public.
Well, I'll try and draft some wording, and then we can think about that, but at the moment... Let's say we talk about perhaps a quarterly report, and it's a number of names and a list of names, and we'll just see how we go with that for the moment. But I can see there's a few different views, so it's just kind of work out what's something that's livable for most of us rather than ideal for every one of us.
But just so I understand, this is a regular report regardless of whether you exceeded the cap during a given period, or only when you've exceeded the cap, then you file your...
I think it would be just a... Well, my interpretation, Brian, is this is coming back to the question of how you would enforce it. And the way of enforcing it is if you've got, Dan raised, how does ICANN know if you're abiding by the policy or not? And the simplest way for ICANN to know that is if they get complaints about names that are not included in the list. So the idea is that, if you have any names that have been extended, then they're just dumped on a list and provided once a quarter, and ICANN can just check that at whatever interval, pretty much based on complaints. If they get one or two complaints, you'd probably ignore it, but if they're starting to get a lot of complaints, then at least they've got something they can investigate.
And when you say extended there, you mean the ones that are extended due to extenuating circumstances, whatever we define them to be?
Yes.
Right.
Actually, Bruce, I think you've hit upon something. I'd be much happier to be responsive to ICANN if they asked for something, like a report, as opposed to having to submit it just as a standard practice every month. So if ICANN thought there was a problem, I'd be happy to produce a report saying, here's what we did this month, and here's the reasons for all the domains. And
I think that's fine, too. I mean, effectively, that's what we have in the transfers policy. The transfers policy basically gives you the ability to request the records if you have a dispute, because each registrar is meant to be sending out a standard form and getting a standard response, and they don't have to submit those to anybody. But if there's a complaint, ICANN could actually go and ask for the copies of the records. So I think that's fine as well.
Yeah, keep in mind that if you're the way of producing a standard report seems to be less work if you're not going to bump up against your cap, because you have discretion. You don't have to file, keep track of the reason why. Whereas if you are going to have to be responsive to ICANN, then you'll have to keep a lot of paperwork on file in order to be prepared to respond to the challenge.
Yeah, I think either way, I think if you write in a requirement that upon request by ICANN, you provide this documentation, which I think is workable, you still have to have tracked those instances and those reasons in order to respond fully. So in any event, you need to do the tracking, but anytime you have regular reporting requirements, it is an additional amount of work, human and otherwise.
Yeah, sorry, I think my point is that as long as you're staying under the cap, there's no reason for you to keep track of paperwork, because there's no basis for, no one cares. You haven't exceeded the cap, so there's no requirement that you be able to respond to any challenge or report any information.
Well, you did, but once you see the threshold, you have to go backwards and collect. If the cap is 250 and you're at 175 and you get a spurt and you go over to 251, you got to collect everything backwards during the period. So, in fact, you do have to be maintaining or monitoring that documentation.
Well, I would suggest probably, to get back to Bruce's point earlier, that you'd keep track of sort of what level you were at and start to collect documentation if you start to get close to the threshold.
This is Dan. Let me just jump in again, hopefully simplify this. Registrars are already required to provide lots of data to ICANN if we ask for it, like about a particular domain or a particular customer. The issue right now is, if a domain is 3 months past expiration, there's no reason for me to even ask about it, because there's no requirement on registrars to delete names within any certain amount of time after. But if you make that requirement and say you must delete, within 45 days after, unless one of these five explicit reasons, A, B, C, D, or E, then if I got a complaint and a domain hadn't been deleted 6 months later, I could say to the registrar, what's going on with this particular domain? And you could tell me it's either A, B, C, D, or E, or you're in trouble, and I can send you a notice of breach. So,
So this is coming back to one of the first points, that you want to effectively have a white list of available extenuating circumstances then.
Yeah, well, if we had that, I'm just trying to, you guys don't want to get them unnecessarily.
You might want to use a combination of those two approaches by listing some extenuating circumstances where there's not going to be any dispute, and that's actually clearer for both the registrar and the registrant. So, for example, let's say UDRP was one of those.
Sure.
That's pretty clear.
Or a court order or a letter from the registrant saying that they sent in a payment or whatever it is.
But what I'm saying is we could list some reasons which are, they're beyond dispute, that they're valid reasons, and then you might still provide some flexibility there for reasons that you haven't thought about.
Can I ask a dumb question? The way the registry auto-renews things, domains are never past expiration. In other words, the domain name would never be past an expiration date at the registry. So how do you determine that the user now will never see that a domain is past expiration date?
They see it in their registrar, but there is an issue in info and bids, you're right.
And actually, I'm going to pick up on, and this is, go ahead, Dan.
That was my whole comment.
This is more like maybe stylistic splitting of hairs, but I talked to my lawyers, and they said in 3.1.2, the phrase 45 days of the expiration of the registration agreement gave them a little pause, because they view that as the expiration date or the anniversary date, and I guess depending on how your service agreement is structured, it could contemplate the grace period and the extensions beyond that. So it was just kind of a wording question about whether that was worded the best possible way. And don't we really mean expiration date or anniversary date?
Yeah,
provide some suggested wording for that, Brian?
Well, I think
sure.
Let me just clarify the intent of the task force on this so that it's clear what we're trying to say, as opposed to, because this is not the same as 311, it's intentionally different language. because this applies to a situation where, for whatever reason, the underlying registration agreement between the registrar and the registrant has gone away, not just a typical expiration, which 311 is intended to apply to. So if a registrant comes to you and says, I want to terminate my contract, there's some provision within the contract for that to happen, for them basically to be able to say, I don't want to have my domain name registered with you anymore.
So the intent is clearly for that specific circumstance.
Right.
Because that makes the edit much easier.
Right, just for the circumstance of the underlying agreement going away.
Right, okay, which is independent.
It sounds like not by virtue of expiration, but by virtue of termination by the registrant.
For whatever reason, if it expires, if it lapses, or if it is explicitly terminated.
Yeah, but the terminated carries... takes into account all of those, I think, Jordan.
We could change the language. Brett's the attorney from the task force, so I defer to him, but I don't have a problem with that.
Because it just okay. I agree with what Brian is saying. When I read it, I thought you were kind of repeating what you had in 3.1.1, but in different words. So.
Okay, well, if you want me to put something together and circulate it, I'm happy to do that. If you'd rather use the other attorney, that's fine by me, too.
No, I just mean, in terms of interpretation, I defer to Brett. Anyone can draft it. I don't really care.
Brian, if you want your lawyers to put something together, that'd be great.
Okay.
Okay. Any other issues you had, Brian?
Actually, just one question, because I'm going to be hopping off early, so I'm sorry to impose. But
too much longer.
Okay, in terms of identifying the list of reasons or extenuating circumstances, how do we propose to together and analyze it?
Well, how about you provide, we've partly got a list from what Dan's provided. I can actually extract from that a starting point, and then perhaps you can add to it, I'll have a go if you like. This is Bruce Tonkin, and send it to the list, and then if others have got other circumstances I think should be added, then we can add that to those.
Okay.
I'm just going to be dealing with the most common ones, the UDRP and so on.
Yeah.
Anything else, Brian?
Nope, that's it. Thanks, all.
Okay, the next major area which concerned me was the section that related to UDRP. My sort of view as well on IT was that it seemed overly prescriptive, and I would have thought the whole section would have been easier dealt with as an extenuating circumstance rather than trying to be really specific about UDRP.
I'm
interested in other comments on that.
I think I would be fine from the perspective of the task force, Bruce. The reason why it's not included that way is because we felt that actually puts a burden on registrars to have to carry names under UDRP dispute. But if registrars are happy carrying the names and potentially getting reimbursed for them, then I don't think anyone from the user side would care.
So can I understand the issue, though? The issue is, and this maybe came from the intellectual property area, is there a problem now? Is there a problem that registrars are deleting the name before the dispute is over, or what's typically happening?
Some registrars renew the names automatically at their cost. Some do something quite similar to the policy outlined by the task force, and some just delete the name.
Right.
So some names under dispute get deleted, and then the complainant essentially has to go and now potentially dispute with someone else, sort of start the whole process over.
So then the action that you're actually wanting then is that under UDRP, the name should not be deleted, and then you can leave it up to the business models as to what happens at that point. For example, Melbourne IT just auto-renews it, and then deals with whoever wins the dispute later on. Other registrars might choose to charge. I'm not sure. I just was worried that we were getting overly prescriptive.
The intent here is just to allow registrars to require that the name be carried, that the option exists for the name to be carried, but not to have registrars be the one that necessarily have to pay for it. The idea is that if the complainant wants the name not to be removed, then by golly, they can pay for it to be renewed. If registrars would rather just bear the cost of the renewal, I don't think the IPC would.
I'll have a look at the wording again. Maybe I can just make that a bit more general, because the way it read to me is like I had to have this. You know, for me as a registrar, the number of these cases aren't very high. The registry cost is $6. The cost for us to actually handle that process that you described would be far more than $6. You know, like giving chargebacks and, you know, if the complainant paid and then the registrant paid and then you refund the complainant, and it was just getting very confusing. So I would prefer it was simplified. So I'll have a go at that to try and get the intent.
Bruce, the stance we've taken is that I don't care who pays for it so long as it gets paid for.
Yeah, well, the problem is unless you have a provision, like if the registrar is just renewing it, then there's a chance that they may not get paid. Because the respondent may have no intention of paying for it. The complainant may not ever want to pay for it, especially if they lose. And if they end up losing at the end, basically the registrar has paid $6.
But with all due respect, if the complainant doesn't pay for it, it ought to delete.
No,
they're not going to pony up the $25 or whatever it is to pay for the domain.
Yeah,
keep it around.
What if the dispute goes beyond the 45-day grace period? Then the registrar is stuck holding the. I mean, they paid the fee and they can't get the money back.
No. What I'm saying is we expire it as normal if it's not paid for. Now, I don't care who pays for it before expiry.
Right, well, that's exactly what the current policy says.
Yeah. So I just need to make the wording flexible. So you're basically saying, Rob, that. For your business model, you would seek payment from somewhere before you would renew the name.
That's correct.
Yeah. So, Bruce, I think you could just add a clause saying registrars who want to avoid this, these other provisions may renew the name at their own expense, in which case these don't apply.
Jordan, this is Dan. I think there was some pushback, I didn't follow too closely, but from John Berryhill, maybe, who was concerned about registrars extending contracts without the registrant's consent. Brett, do you remember about that?
Yeah, I mean, he said that it's often the times the case that a registrant who gets hit with a UDRP near the end of the registration term will just decide to do nothing, not respond to the UDRP and not renew the domain name.
Right, and then basically what he would be saying in that circumstance is that the registrar can go ahead and delete the name unless the complainant...
Unless the complainant objects, which they very well may, unless they're next in line to get it, you know, through something like WLS or something, because what the complainant doesn't want to have happen is to then have some other cyber squatter grab it.
Grab it, yeah, I understand, yeah. Okay, yeah, so, I'll have a look at the wording and see if I can...
But shouldn't they just pay the $25 and take the chance on the case? They paid $3,000 or $4,000 already to start the UDRP.
I think the complainant would want the opportunity to pay that fee and keep it active.
Well, that's exactly what the existing task force recommendation has concluded, is that the complainant ought to pay for it. If the respondent doesn't want to pay for the name, then the registrar shouldn't pay, the complainant should.
Exactly, if the complainant is paying the fee, that you actually can't make a registrant enter into a contract without its consent. So that ought to actually work in like a transfer. But because I think John's concern was that if I have a contract for a year for a domain name registration, and I want that thing to expire, no one should be able to make me continue to have that contract for another year.
Right. So then you're talking about effectively. The registrant transferring the name to the complainant, is that what we're talking about then?
Bruce, if you go through it, I mean, I understand why you said it looks excessively complex, because from watching on the sidelines, they went through a lot of back and forth and tried to balance all these interests and who would want what. I think what they came up with was that in that situation, if the registrant doesn't want it but the complainant wants to pay, the registrar is supposed to renew it and sort of keep it on ice. And if the complainant wins, they give the name to the complainant, but if not, then they just delete it.
Okay, I'll have a look at the wording, but I'll just be looking to try and simplify it, I suppose.
Dan, it's Rob. Is there any problem with just giving it to the complainant? I mean, this guy's gone through, a $3,000 or $4,000 process to say, I want this name. The registrant's saying, I don't want it anymore.
Yeah, no, I think there is a problem, because then you could just essentially use that as a way of
super
gaining rights to a name that you don't really have any rights to.
Yeah, but only if the other guy doesn't want it. Like, the other guy is giving up, saying, I don't want this anymore.
Yeah, that's fine, but there's nothing then about filing a UDRP dispute that grants you special rights over a name.
Exactly.
I don't know. It just, you know, it seems to me they've paid a few $1,000 to do it. It's not like they're able to do it en masse. You know?
So they're a well-funded cyber squatter instead of a
you're saying a cyber squatter is going to try and launch a UDRP when he thinks a domain may not be renewed?
Sure. For a good name, why not?
Hmm.
And they pay more going other ways. So.
There have been a number of UDRP cases decided where basically it was viewed as a case of reverse cyber squatting. So
that's true. Okay.
Absolutely.
So Bruce is going to take another look at that.
Okay. So, and on the last point, what's the sort of view there? My sort of feeling is that we'd be better off waiting until the Who Is are implemented and we have some experience with them before trying to add more to the issue of redemption grace period. But what's the sort of feeling of others on that?
Yeah, Bruce, let me just, the task force did not intend to have language that conflicted with the Who Is task force at all, and I think we could certainly say that the council doesn't need to act on that particular action because it's already been handled by the Who Is task force.
Yeah, I think the way to handle it probably, Jordan, is to say that in the Who Is task force, there's a, after the recommendations of the Who Is task force are implemented, I think 6 months or 12 months later, they're meant to be reviewed, and perhaps that would be the time to then relook at the recommendation here at, in that context to see whether it was needed or whether changes were needed.
Yeah, I don't think there's enough of a divergence between the two. I think they both capture the same intent, and there was no intention. They actually just sort of moved it at the last minute while we were publishing our report, so it's just
that's
serendipity true. That it happened that way.
Yeah. Okay, any other comments on Worcester Roads?
On what, sir?
Anything else? I'm about to close the call, unless you've got something else you'd like to talk about, Rob.
I'd like to ask the wisdom behind the 180 days in 3.1.3. It seems to me that you may want to, these are contracts that we have to modify with users. From our point of view, we would prefer to do it almost immediately on any new domain or any domain that's renewed, so that we're touching the contract on that expiration date, we do it. And I gather that would mean that typically within a year, you'd have everybody.
I'm not sure there's any modification that would be required between the registrar and the registrant.
Well, you're asking me to publish now details of how I do it, which would affect my contract, I would imagine.
I mean, I haven't heard that perspective. If registrars widely think that, then maybe, you know, I could be wrong. But we ask for publication basically of what should be the then current policy. It has no bearing on your existing contracts with other registrants.
But I may have to change my policy based on...
I mean, I guess if you publish the policy with your registrant that's contrary to this, then that may be the case.
And I understand you want to implement it as fast as possible, but typically it would be better to do it on the anniversary date of the domain.
Well, could be 10 years from now, so you're saying...
No, the anniversary date, not necessarily the renewal.
Mm-hmm.
I see the problem, though. You're saying someone could have paid for 10 years
already. Yeah, exactly.
So... Because that's the easiest time for us to touch the client. You know, they're agreeing to a new contract.
This is Dan. I wasn't sure exactly what that sentence meant, either myself. 313.
I assume that most contracts basically say that the registrar can change certain service terms and conditions, you know, by notice.
Yeah, I can't imagine registrars have contracts that say anything explicitly to the contrary of any of these recommendations.
I have to sign off. This is Dan. Thank you all. Talk to you later.
Thanks, Dan. Just one other thing. The wording that relates to display of information, what I suggested, just to clear up the question that Dan raised about website, was just to include words to the effect that if you have a website, you need to display it or something like that, as opposed to requiring somebody to have a website if they don't have one.
Or just this must be disclosed. So if you do business by handshake and a paper or something,
yeah,
maybe just give it to them in paper.
Yeah,
I think the point is if you do have a website, which the vast majority of registrars do, then you ought to put it there.
Yeah, so the wording I put in there, Jordan, was just to say if you have a website, that was the...
Yeah, no, your wording's fine, Bruce, from my perspective.
All right, I have to go pick up my daughter at preschool, so I'll talk to you guys later, and I'm happy to participate. any way I can help, but I got to go this minute. Talk to you later.
Thanks very much, Dan.
Bye.
Okay, what I suggest I do then is I'll try and do another draft of the document based on the discussion we've just had, I might ask for some people to put where I think Brian, for example, was going to suggest some text for some parts of the agreement. So we'll try and do it via email, but perhaps schedule a teleconference for a week's time and just see where we're up to.
Yeah, that's fine. I'll be flying a week from this very moment, so that's not the best time for me in particular, but sometime around then would be good.
Yeah, when are you available, Joe?
Pretty much any time other than between, say, 5 and 11 p.m. Eastern time on next Thursday.
Okay, well, that's quite specific. Okay, so just make it a different day then.
Yeah, just not right now. Just not a week from right now.
All right, okay. I'll have maybe Wednesday next week or something. Okay. Thanks everyone for attending and for your comments.
Thanks. Thanks, Bruce.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bruce?
Yes?
Did you get my email that Marilyn asked you if you wanted to make any comments to call to me? Because Marilyn's in Washington, Paul Toomey's there, and she's seeing him privately on Saturday morning, and she thought...
Is this an email that you've sent me, Glenn?
Yeah.
When did you send it?
Oh, I sent it in my evening sometime. If you haven't seen your emails yet, you'll probably get it.
From Marilyn? Right.
No, it's from me.
Yes, I've just spoken to Marilyn.
Oh, you've just spoken to Marilyn. Okay, fine, then that's all right.
Okay. So I should just send Marilyn an email, is that?
Yes, you should just tell Marilyn if there's anything that that you think she should talk to Paul Toomey about.
Okay.
Okay.
Problem.
All right. Have a good day, Bruce.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, bye.
Bye.